Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
I guess I should say howdy, everybody. Well, welcome back to the Inside Scoop. As I said, I am thieving half an hour from Bob's time because I wanted to give the full context of what Obama said in response to Jeremiah Wright, and then hopefully we don't have to mention it anymore once you hear the full context. Some of you in the chat room were asking about what Jeremiah Wright specifically said on the government and AIDS, and I think it's certainly fair to hear what he had to say. In its full context, so that I'm not putting words in his mouth. I certainly believe in giving full context. Let me play for you his response on that question.
In your sermon, you said the government lied about inventing the HIV virus as a means of genocide against people of color. So I ask you, do you honestly believe your statement and those words?
Have you read Horowitz's book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola? Whoever wrote that question? Have you read Medical Apartheid? You read it? Is that one of the reporters?
No questions
from the floor. I read different things, as I said to my members. If you haven't read things, then you can't. Yeah. Based on this Tuskegee experiment and based on what has happened to Africans in this country, I believe our government is capable of doing anything. In fact, one of the responses to what Saddam Hussein had in terms of biological warfare was a non-question, because all we had to do was check the sales record. We sold him those biological weapons that he was using against his own people. So anytime a government can put together biological warfare to kill people and then get angry when those people use what we sold them, yes, I believe we are capable.
You have likened Israeli policies to apartheid and its treatment of Palestinians with Native Americans. Can you explain your views on Israel?
Where did I liken them to that? Whoever wrote the question, tell me where I likened them. Jimmy Carter called it apartheid. Jeremiah Wright didn't liken anything to anything. My position on Israel is that Israel has a right to exist, that Israelis have a right to exist, as I said, reconciled one to another. Have you read The Link? Do you read The Link? Americans for Middle Eastern Understanding, where Palestinians and Israelis need to sit down and talk to each other and work out a solution where their children can grow in a world together and not be talking about killing each other. That is not God's will for my.
So I'll stop it there. I wanted you to hear a little bit about his response on Israel, which actually isn't extreme at all. He supports Israel's right to exist and argues for reconciliation. But the part that was most controversial, obviously, was where he talks about the AIDS virus. And it's interesting because the reporter in the room, the way they worked at the press club is that the reporters had to write their questions on cards and then submit it to the moderator. And Jeremiah Wright would ask back, have you read certain books? And the reporter tried to answer and said, do you honestly believe this? And then Wright said, well, no, you're not allowed to ask questions off the floor. But the heart of what Jeremiah Wright was saying was that based on the Tuskegee experiment, which I've talked about, and if you don't know what that is, you should. It's where a long-running syphilis experiment where the government took African-Americans who had syphilis and even after treatments were available, didn't treat them to see the course of the disease. It's a horrible breach of medical ethics and really a criminal act. Because of Tuskegee, because we sold biological weapons to Saddam Hussein, because of all these things that our government really did do, that we're capable of anything. It's the argument I know Dave from California makes from time to time, and I'm not picking on you, Dave. I think it's when you say that, as I've said before, that's a very dangerous thing, because even if our government is capable of anything, to say they've done anything because they're capable of anything, really, well, that's no argument at all. To say the government's capable of anything, and then I could argue anything that's bad that happens on Earth is the government's fault. You know, they developed the Hurricane Katrina, not that they failed to help people, but they actually made the winds blow. I mean, I can argue anything. It's this kind of dangerous conspiracy. But I did want you to hear what Wright had to say. And then I want to go back and play more of Barack Obama's response. And folks, don't let the fact that I'm playing these let you hesitate from calling in. If you want to call in and comment on anything I've said, anything Obama has said, anything Wright has said, or to answer the overall question that I want to answer near the end of the half hour, which is why did Wright turn on Obama? Why? What is Wright's motivation in doing this? Why did he, in fact, I think, sabotage Obama? That's the question I'm really looking for an answer to. I'll give you my response, but I'm curious to know what you think. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Let's go back, though, and hear Obama's quite angry response to Jeremiah Wright.
That's a question about, you know, why it's a little different now. Have you heard from some of your supporters? You know, you have some obviously some Obama supporters who expressed any alarm about what this might be doing to the campaign.
I don't think that it's that hard to figure out from if it was just a purely political perspective. My reaction has more to do with what I want this campaign to be about and who I am. And I want to make certain that people understand who I am. In some ways, what Reverend Wright said yesterday directly contradicts everything that I've done during my life. It contradicts how I was raised and the setting in which I was raised. It contradicts my decisions to pursue a career of public service. It contradicts the issues that I've worked on politically. It contradicts what I've said in my books. It contradicts what I said in my convention speech in 2004. It contradicts my announcement. It contradicts everything that I've been saying on this campaign trail. What I tried to do in Philadelphia was to provide a context and to lift up some of the contradictions and complexities of race in America, of which, you know, Reverend Wright is a part and we're all a part, and try to make something constructive out of it. But there wasn't anything constructive out of yesterday. All it was a bunch of rants that aren't grounded in truth. And, you know, I can't construct something positive out of that. I can understand it. People do all sorts of things. And as I said before, I continue to believe that Reverend Wright has been a leader in the South Side. I think that the church he built is outstanding. I think that he has preached in the past some wonderful sermons. He provided valuable contributions to my family. But at a certain point, if what somebody says contradicts what you believe so fundamentally, and then he questions whether or not you believe it in front of the National Press Club, then that's enough. That's a show of disrespect to me. Is also, I think, an insult to what we've been trying to do in this campaign.
Yeah. Did you discuss with your wife after having seen Reverend Wright's performance and what was her?
Yeah, no, she was similarly angry, Joe.
Reverend Wright said that it was not an attack on him, but an attack on the black church. First of all, do you agree with that? And second of all, the strain of theology that he preached, black liberation theology, you explained something about the anger that feeds some of the sentiments in the church in Philadelphia. How important a strain is liberation theology in the black church? And why did you choose to attend a church that preached that?
Well, first of all, In terms of liberation theology, I'm not a theologian. I think to some theologians there might be some well worked out theory of what constitutes liberation theology versus non-liberation theology. I went to church and listened to sermons, and in the sermons that I heard, and this is true, I do think across the board in many black churches, there is an emphasis on the importance of social struggle, the importance of striving for equality and justice and fairness, a social gospel. So I think a lot of people would rather than using a fancy word like that, simply talk about preaching the social gospel. And that there's nothing particularly odd about that. Dr. King obviously was the most prominent example of that kind of preaching. But you know, what I do think can happen, and I didn't see this as a member of the church, but I saw it yesterday, is when you start focusing so much on the plight of the historically oppressed, that you lose sight of what we have in common, that it overrides everything else, that we're not concerned about the struggles of others because we're looking at things only through a particular lens, then it doesn't describe properly what I believe in the power of faith to overcome but also to bring people together. Now, you had a first question, Joe, that I don't remember. I did not view the initial round of sound bites that triggered this controversy as an attack on the black church. I viewed it as a simplification of who he was, a caricature of who he was, more than anything, something that piqued a lot of political interest. I didn't see it as an attack on the black church. Probably the only aspect of it that probably had to do with specifically the black church is the fact that some people were surprised when he was shouting. I mean, that is just a black church tradition, and so I think some people interpreted that somehow as, wow, he's hollering, and black preachers holler and whoop, and so that I think showed sort of a cultural gap in America. The sad thing is that although the sound bites I created a caricature of him, and when he was in that Moyers interview, even though there were some things that continued to be offensive, at least there was some sense of rounding out the edges. Yesterday, I think he caricatured himself, and that was, as I said, that made me angry, but also made me sad.
Last question.
Richard.
You talked about giving him the benefit of the doubt for, especially, I guess, in the Philadelphia speech, and trying to create something positive
right
about that. Did you consult with him before the speech or talk to him after the speech in Philadelphia to get his reaction or his input?
You know, I tried to talk to him before the speech in Philadelphia. Wasn't able to reach him because he was on a cruise. He had just stepped down from the pulpit. When he got back, I did speak to him. I prefer not to share sort of private conversations between me and him. I will talk to him perhaps someday in the future. But what I can say is that I was very clear that what he had said in those particular snippets I found objectionable and offensive, and that the intention of the speech was to provide context for them but not excuse them. because I found them inexcusable. Go ahead.
The other day on Sunday, you were asked whether to respond to Biden's claim that he's still having a problem with Mr. Biden. Is this, you think, a bullying irreparable damage? Is this relationship with you and Mark irreparable damage?
There's been great damage. It may have been unintentional on his part, but I do not see that relationship being the same after this. Now, to some degree, I know that one thing that he said was true was that he was never my quote unquote spiritual advisor. He was never my spiritual mentor. He was my pastor. And so to some extent how the press characterized in the past that relationship, I think, wasn't accurate. But he was somebody who was my pastor and married Michelle and I and baptized my children and prayed with us at when we announced this race. And so so I'm disappointed.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Well, you heard it. I wanted to play at length Obama's comments. I thought it was important. Sometimes, as someone who tries to give you the inside scoop, it's important for me to get out of the way and just let you hear what people have to say directly, because I think that the Republicans certainly and the media most probably are going to be talking about Jeremiah Wright, as I said, all the way up until November. And so I wanted you to hear extended. I played most of Obama's press conference for you. Now, if you want to call in, there's still time, but before the end of my half hour here on Bob's show at 877-4-HEAD-ON, some of you in the chat room are saying, this wasn't sabotaging Obama. In fact, in some ways, it helped Obama. And I guess in some ways it did. I mean, Jeremiah Wright did give Obama the excuse he needed to finally close that door. Back in Philadelphia, in the speech on race, you may recall, Obama said that he could no more distance himself from his pastor than he could from a crazy old uncle in the family that says things that we find reprehensible. Or he even talked about his white grandmother who would occasionally express to him her fears of young black men when she was walking in the streets. And yet I think he's now done that. He has now closed the door. You heard at the end the question, is your relationship with Wright irreparably damaged? And he said there's been great damage. I don't know that he ever wants to say anything is irreparable, but he made clear that there was great damage. And I don't think we will be seeing Reverend Wright in the White House. I don't think we'll be seeing him as giving the benediction at Obama's inauguration should he win the election. I think that this is pretty much the end of their relationship. I mean, Obama even suggested that he might not be able to go to church anymore, not because of the church, which he thinks is wonderful, or the parishioners, but because of his disagreements with Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Now, I do think, and you disagree, call in, let me know why. I do think that Jeremiah Wright had it in for Barack Obama. And I think he did for very personal reasons, for the same reasons that real human beings disagree with each other. I think that you heard from Barack Obama, and this, by the way, from here on out, is pure speculation. I mean, I don't know what's going on in the men's minds. I don't know of any conversations other than the ones that they have talked about in the press. So I'm speculating here, and like I said, you're welcome to speculate as well by calling in. But in my view, Barack Obama tried to reach Jeremiah Wright prior to the Philadelphia speech. He couldn't. Wright was on a cruise. He gives the Philadelphia speech, which, by the way, I think still is one of the finest speeches in American history. If you haven't heard it, please go to YouTube and listen to it. It's not, I don't think it's even 30 minutes long, but it's a really wonderful speech on race and America. But Obama, I think, very clearly in that speech was trying to say that Reverend Wright's anger was real, that the anger of African Americans is real, that it comes from centuries of slavery and Jim Crow, but that today in 2008, a lot of that anger just isn't productive. And I agree with Barack Obama that the anger, while justified, while completely justified, is not that productive. Now, there are things we need to do with that anger. I believe in an apology for slavery. I think we've got to have a museum about slavery and about the African-American experience on the Washington Mall. I certainly believe that the time is not yet here to end affirmative action. There are real things that need to be done because of our past, racism. But America is not only its past. It's not only its past racism. It's not only its past of slavery and Jim Crow. It's a future, too. And that's why I think Barack Obama straddles the line between the past and the future. That's what I think he was trying to do in his speech in Philadelphia. And while I think Obama gave a good speech, I think Wright was personally miffed. And he saw Obama as saying to him, you are a creature of the past. You have no relevance to today. And I think Wright was trying to get Obama back. I do think he was trying to sabotage Obama and trying to get his 15 seconds of fame. But some of you may disagree. Gary from Maryland may disagree. I don't know. Gary, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good. What are your thoughts?
I disagree a little bit.
Okay.
I don't think he was actually trying to sabotage Obama, per se, himself, but more his ideas of what he's trying to do. Now, maybe some people will say, hey, well, that's part of sabotaging him. But I think ultimately that's how we have to look at it. Because I think what's happening right now, we just have basically, I think it's even going beyond racism. I think we're having like a generational divide.
Well, I agree with that.
Like Pat Buchanan, you know, you see him on TV. And you see him almost kind of like, when I hear him talk, he seems to be talking about this old way that a certain perspective of white Americans have. And he keeps trying to push that agenda that whites won't change. They're not going to vote for this black man. He doesn't even want to accept the fact that the white people voted for him in Iowa, you know. And,
right.
And I think
and New Hampshire and Nevada and other places too.
Yeah. If you watch, I don't know if you watch the show, but if you've seen him talk, they have to literally remind him that, you know, people, white people, voted for Obama. And I think you see the same thing with Jeremiah Wright. He has these old ideas about liberating black people that have some legitimacy in terms of the way they could be implemented. The times have changed, and the way we have more or less integrated to the society, and as that happens, it's about liberating everybody, just not black people, but white as well.
Gary, I think that's very well said, and I think it's very much Obama's philosophy. Obama was asked in the Philadelphia debate about affirmative action, and he pointed out that disadvantaged white people, just like disadvantaged black people, need to have a step up. And I think in many ways, and that's what Obama was trying to say in Philadelphia, that there was a time, in the time of Jim Crow, when, the anger and all justified some really dramatic changes. And today there's still changes that need to be made, but as you say, it's something that we can all work on together. And I like the way you described it. I think Buchanan is sort of the flip side of Jeremiah Wright, in a white way, you know. And both Wright and Buchanan, that generation, are saying we can't come together as Americans. Both of them are living in the 50s and the 60s and the segregated eras. Both are definitely part of our past, but I don't think they're part of our future. I think you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it seems like they won't step aside. It's like...
No, they sure won't. And Obama really wants him to. You know,
yeah,
Obama... You could see in his face...
Go play golf. Please, go play some golf, will you?
Exactly. He's like, take your cruise and go to enjoy your retirement. I think Obama was very surprised by what Reverend Wright did last weekend. I think Wright had been silent long enough that everyone in the Obama campaign pretty much decided, okay, we're done, we're over this, we're moving on, and then he came back like a bad penny. And
they knew he was coming, and they tried to stop him. Everybody, a lot of people there, from what I understand, was trying to tell him, don't go into, don't do it. It's a media trap. And he went for it, and like you said, I think the vanity caught in, and his so-called 15 minutes caught in, and it went to his head. I mean, he got drunk on it. I mean, that's what happened.
I think he did, too. What's interesting is that Wright mentioned that his own mother tried to stop him. I don't know how old his mother is, but basically his own mother, you know, quoted the Bible, saying better to be thought a fool with your mouth shut than to open your mouth and be proved a fool. And so he announced that. And then the other thing about it was, did you see him at the press conference, Gary? Did you see the clips?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. To me, part of it wasn't just what he said, but how he said it. You know,
no, I agree. I actually agree with a lot of stuff he says, actually. I'll be straight up with
I agree with a lot of what he said, too, particularly in the first half hour. I mean, it seems to me that he wrote a speech in the first half hour that clearly was vetted. You could tell people in his congregation had looked it over. What he said in the first half hour was quite reasonable. It's only when he got out on a limb with the question and answer session that's where he lost it. I mean, had he stopped after the first half hour, he could have sat down, he could have rehabilitated himself a little bit. Obama wouldn't have needed to say anything. He just should have said, I will take no questions. But once he started taking those questions...
He's overstepped.
What's that?
When he did the Bill Moyers interview, I was thinking, okay, that's enough. That's all he had to do.
Right.
Let that
marinate
for a while. Maybe come back two or three weeks later and do another little interview, maybe on Larry King. But keep everything calm. You know, just do it very slowly.
But at the press conference, I tell you, I think he was buoyed up a bit by the audience. And I think that's very common for preachers, actually. Frankly, it's common for me. I have to admit, I've done a lot of speeches in public, and there's nothing that a public speaker likes better than hearing audience feedback, whether it be laughter or clapping or just a response. And that really buoys you up. And I know I've seen it in the black church, definitely with preachers, but I've also seen it when I give speeches myself and people laugh and you get excited, you get full of yourself. Well, he was loving his fame. He was talking down to the national press. He was talking smack, actually, is what he was doing, and smiling and doing little dances, and was very, very pleased with himself, and a little too pleased with himself. If he had been a little more serious, if he'd been a little more sad, if he'd been a little more respectful, I think actually he could have said most of what he said, not the extreme stuff, not the AIDS stuff, but most of what he said and gotten a different reaction. But instead, he really, I think, treated it like a clown. Obama called it a spectacle. And in doing so, I think Wright really hurt his own image as well as Obama's.
And I can tell you, just a black person who's out and around even today, and people I know who just come up to me, or just because, and I've heard this from other people too, just calling parents and friends, the black community is outraged. I mean, completely outraged over this.
At Wright.
Oh, yeah. It's like, you know.
Because I should tell you, I have heard from some, and I think they're a minority, but I have heard from some in the black community who are mad at Obama for distancing himself from Wright. But I think that's a minority view. Most black people I know are, like you say, mad at Wright.
Yeah, I mean, the thing we probably went a little bit too far, maybe when he really kind of went toward Farrakhan and started going out to Farrakhan a little bit in that speech. You should be. Farrakhan in Chicago is a very somewhat revered figure. He probably could have just left that hanging. Even though I don't agree with Farrakhan's views, I mean, I think, you know, Farrakhan probably shouldn't have came into the whole lexicon. It should have been just by him and Wright at that point.
Wright could have avoided the question. Wright actually was very good at avoiding some of the questions. I remember one question was asked of Wright where he said, they said, well, you know, Obama apparently didn't attend all your sermons. Did he fall asleep in the pews? And Wright quite deftly turned on the questioner and said, do you remember what your pastor said last week? Okay, then. And then he just didn't answer the question. I mean, he could have not...
condescending to the person. I thought she was very condescending. You know, I know he didn't like the questions, and maybe they were a set of questions. But I didn't get the feeling that the young lady who was giving him the questions, you know, was somebody he should attack. You know, to me, it was just disrespectful. I mean,
the other thing is that most of the questions she didn't write. I mean, most of the questions were written from members of the press, and she's just reading off the card. But I guess on Farrakhan, he could have elided the question. He could have said, look, you know, this isn't about Farrakhan. You know, I agree with some things. I disagree with some things. He didn't have to say he's one of, you know, when E.F. Hutton talks, you know, when Farrakhan talks, blacks listen. You know, I know plenty of black people who don't listen.
Do you listen? Ever listen to Sean Hannity at all? I know it's hard.
Sometimes. Usually no. Yeah, but occasionally I have heard him, yes.
When I was coming home today, I was listening to him on the radio. He had Michael Steele on, you know, the guy here from Maryland. He was a lieutenant governor here. High up.
I remember Michael Steele.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't he run for senator?
They were actually gleeful. They were gleeful on the radio. They were like, oh, Sean, you should give praise for bringing up this Reverend Wright issue. And, I mean, almost as though they were having, like, the celebratory thing that they've finished Obama. That's how they were acting on the radio.
That's how they think. Yeah. No, that doesn't surprise me. I'm sorry to say that doesn't surprise me, that they would be gleeful about it. I think they finished off Obama. And the sad thing is, in the latest poll, up until this, one of the reasons why I voted for Obama, I like Barack Obama, but I like Hillary Clinton too. I've never been someone who really trashes either one of them. I had a very close decision, and one of the reasons I voted for Obama, at least at the time I did, which was the time of the Virginia primary, was because he was beating McCain a lot more than Hillary Clinton. At the time I voted for Obama, he was beating McCain by 10 points, and she was beating him by 2 points. Now the latest poll I've seen shows her beating McCain by 2 points and shows Obama losing to McCain by 0.2. Now, obviously, this is April. There's a long time before November. I do think Obama can recoup from this, but there's no question that Wright has hurt him. There's just no question about it, and that's why the Republicans are gleeful.
Yeah, but if they think this thing is going to stay static like this, and if McCain is only beating him by 2 points after this guy is taking, as far as I'm concerned, death blows. I mean, he's getting hit from his Hillary. I mean, the Clinton machine, which is a powerful machine. I mean,
absolutely.
He's getting hit from the Republicans, McCain, and not his own pastor. And he's only down. What happens when he recruits?
One of the things I actually like about this is that I think it shows that he can take a hit. One of the concerns I had about Obama way back in February when I voted for him was that he'd never really been battle tested. I mean, here's a guy who, you know, was given his Illinois Senate seat. He really was. The Republican Jack Ryan had an affair and sort of died out. His two primary opponents had problems, and he waltzed right in against the easiest opponent in the world, literally a crazy man, Alan Keyes. One of my concerns, and it's something that I think Hillary Clinton helped brought about, but I think she wasn't wrong, is that, you know, she has been tested. They have thrown the kitchen sink at her. And at the time I voted for Obama in February, they hadn't thrown the kitchen sink at him. And I kind of did want to see how he responded to adversity. And what, to me, the Wright incident shows, Reverend Wright may actually in the long run have done him a favor, because it shows that Obama can take a hit. The reason I played so much from his press conference is I wanted to show, I guess, how Obama thinks. And here I think he was angry and he was sad, but he was angry in a very different sense from when John McCain gets angry. You know, he hits people. He screams at people. Obama is not that kind of person. It seems to me like I could just see Obama dealing with, you know, an Iranian leader or something like that, where at one point he says, you know, enough is enough. You know, he said about Wright, he tried to give him the benefit of the doubt, but enough is enough. I could see him saying that about an Iranian leader. You know, I tried to give him the benefit of the doubt, but enough is enough. It was good for me to see Obama pushed to the wall, and he was, to see how he responds. And I think he responded in a way that was rational, that was measured, that didn't discount the power of what happened, and yet at the same time tried to work it in a way for the future. I was very impressed with his response. And
I think that he does. He has the ability to
make, he's very calm.
Well, he's very calm, and again, I'm not going to, when I say this, I'm not saying this as some, like, Obama is the one or the Messiah or something.
Right.
He does have some kind of uncanny ability to freeze time when he really gets serious, like that race speech. I mean, that thing was all over the place. And he came out with this one speech on, like, it was like 8 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and he just froze everybody, just froze the whole nation.
Well, that's the speech that will always be remembered. I think that speech is going to go down in American history, along with, like, Kennedy's speech on Catholicism. It will be remembered as one of the great speeches in American history. But what I liked about yesterday also, yesterday was not a speech. I mean, the race speech he'd written in advance, and he was reading from a teleprompter, and he had yesterday there was no written text. It was just Obama, you know, thinking on his feet and being angry, and but at the same time doing it in a measured way. I mean, you can see a John McCain, or frankly, certainly a Dick Cheney, who said go F yourself to various members of you know, the Senate. When they get angry, they just go off and they just yell at people and shout obscenities and push people around. Obama was clearly upset, but he responded, I think, in a statesmanlike manner. And so, at the end of the day, this may end up being good for him. It shows what he does when he's pushed against the wall. Now, my fear, and one of the reasons why I played the Obama's press conference almost in its entirety, was my fear is that people aren't going to hear that. That they'll just remember, oh, crazy black preacher, and that'll be spread by Sean Hannity and Fox News, and they won't hear how Obama actually addressed it with the dignity that he did. And
I think they will. I think the people who are following him, who are voting for him, is with him. But I think you're right. There's going to be a certain group that's not going to hear him. But I think that group might be away from him at this point anyway. I think the thing was what, you know, and I was like a big time Clinton supporter, you know, at one point, you know, Clinton, you know, I liked him and everything. And I loved Hillary. But it seems like Hillary right now, and it's where I kind of ventured off with her when she started to go negative, because the one side of when she really go negative is that you kind of cap yourself. You get a feeling, and if you notice, she can never get like a really substantial lead over Obama, because I think she really has capped herself with people in the party. I mean, you see how the superdelegates are just continuing to flow away, and I don't think it's because of Obama's strength so much sometimes. I think they just don't like the way she's run her campaign.
I think there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. Like I said, for me, it was a tough choice in February between Clinton and Obama, but each day went by, I liked Obama better. And I agree with you. I think Hillary's gone too far. Lately, she's backed off. Lately, she hasn't been so negative. I think she extremely wisely did not comment on this whole Reverend Wright stuff. That was very wise of her. Anything she said could and would have been used against her. She didn't need to say anything. You know, Wright was doing his own damage, and Obama was hurting, and she didn't have to say anything. I think she has retracted her claws a bit,
right now,
if you will.
They better not step into this right now. Clinton, they're smart, because African-American right now, and they're very angered about what happened. And if she steps into this now, she can kiss the black. She already has a problem with the black vote as it is. She steps into this now with this guy. You know, this is with especially African American pastors and stuff like that. You don't step in that.
No, and she was right not to. And that's sort of my point. She's getting smarter about that. Look, Hillary Clinton just doesn't have a chance. I mean, the math is the math is the math. And Barack Obama is going to end this election ahead, not just in pledged delegates, but in the popular vote. If Barack Obama wins Indiana, he's expected to win North Carolina. But if he wins Indiana, there might be one less chance for Hillary to get out. But even if she doesn't, I'm convinced Obama has the nomination. What I want to see, though, is the party coming together, and that's why I am concerned about Reverend Wright. I am concerned about how they'll use it. And frankly, even though I fully expect her to give him a vice presidential nomination if she wins, I think he should consider giving her a vice presidential slot. I mean, this is as close to a tie as we've come. I think he's going to win. But that may be the only thing that brings the party together, because there are people that are attracted to her. We've seen that in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. I think he should consider making her a vice president.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, I would have been all for it a couple of months ago. But my question is how would they manage that together? Could she work under him? I mean, that's the thing I would wonder.
Well, Obama's a healer. I think he's in charge.
But I'm saying, we really think we keep saying this. How do we know she would take it?
Oh, I don't know she'd take it. But I think she would. I think she would. But I don't know. I think she would. How can you reject vice president? I mean, how can you reject that? I mean, you'd have to be really, I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine anyone rejecting being offered a vice presidential nomination. That's you know, second best job in the world? I don't know. Hey, Gary, thanks for your call. I really appreciate your perspective, and I hope you'll call in again sometime.
Yeah, man, take care.
You too. Take care. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Like I said, I went into Bob's hour a bit. Bob is having some technical problems, so I think we're going to be running a rerun. If I'm wrong, Agnes will let everyone know. But I hope you've enjoyed the Inside Scoop today. And hopefully, after all this discussion, we can finally put this behind us. Obama can put this behind us. The media will put this behind us. Even if Reverend Wright goes on a 23-city speaking tour at this point, after Obama has completely distanced himself from him, it seems to me Wright is old news. And it's time to move on. And I hope that by talking about it today, by talking about it this weekend, we can move on. We can get past this. I fear we won't, but I hope we will. And actually, isn't that part of the audacity of hope? That's it for the Inside Scoop. Tune in tomorrow. If you have comments, post them at radioinsidescoop.com. This is Mark Levine signing off.
Thank you for sticking with us. Bob will be here shortly at the top of the hour. We hope you enjoy this interview from Charleston. And we will be killing the stream here in the studio and waiting for Bob. Until later, thank you for sticking with Head On Radio.
Thank you. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Welcome, welcome, welcome. The show is on the road. You know how this works. I'm Bob. You're wonderful, you. I'm on the campus. We are on the campus of West Virginia State University. I feel a little bit like a golf announcer here because I usually project into the microphone pretty clearly. And I can't do it. And he's putting. And we're on the 18th green. If he sinks this one, he'll win the Masters. So it's a little bit tough to do right now, but okay. Gee, Agnes, you said I'm hot. I thought you might lower the mic gain. Okay, my bad. You know, after all, tomorrow's our anniversary. I thought you were like, you know, being a little randy, baby. But anyway, it's about 5 minutes past seven. We should be getting the program started here presently. And you'll be hearing from Ray McGovern, former CIA agent and intense, fierce critic of the Bush administration. He spent his career in government service. Well, you know, I'm no fan of the CIA, but it is what it is. Oh. Yeah, that's what you always say, up just a little bit. Now say, there we go. All right, just 1 second. I think we're getting ready to start. I'll be right back. We're doing video, too, so I'm, you know, two or three things at one time. Okay, all better now. I've got tape rolling for the video. Great crowd on hand here. A couple of hundred folks at the very least. And we've got someone well, no, it doesn't look like the right person. I was going to say someone approaching the podium, but no, that was a dry run. We'll get started here in a couple of minutes, though. Seneca 2 is a wonderful, wonderful group that's brought... Well, you may remember the last time I was down here, it was for an address by Scott Ritter. Coming up in July, both down here at West Virginia State University and through the good offices of Dr. Bill O'Brien at Concord University's Beckley campus, we'll be hearing from David K. Johnston, author of Perfectly Legal, as well as Free Lunch, I believe is the title of his latest book. And that'll be truly, truly exciting because, you know, he's done a wonderful job of explaining how we're getting ripped off. As far as Ray McGovern is concerned, he's a retired CIA officer. He is a political activist, former federal employee under seven U.S. presidents over the past 27 years. He was the guy who gave the morning intelligence briefing at the White House for a number of years during his career. Now, however, in his retirement, he has turned his attention to the Bush administration having actually taken the what seemed then incredibly risky step of calling Donald Rumsfeld a liar to his face. Of course, that qualifies as heroism in my book. I expect we'll hear a lot of a lot about this sort of thing this evening. He is also, of course, a vocal opponent of torture, as should be just about any decent human being. And, well, I think I see them both up at the podium. I'm hoping that perhaps we're getting ready to get started. I'd feel a lot more comfortable if I was in a booth or something and I could just speak freely. I mean, I don't want everybody turning around like, oh, this is weird. I don't do public appearances. Yeah. Well, blast. Now they've walked away from the podium, so that means I have... Do I have to just start doing a regular show now? Agnes says good audio. Wonderful, 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 wonderful. Hey, Agnes, just... well, I can type it to you faster. So I tell you what we're gonna do. Great, the website's back up. I can go into the chat. Well, I bet I can't get into the chat there. Too bad for me. I don't know. Is this the part where I put my foot in the bucket and sing? Not much of a tap dancer. So, let's see. This thing was slated to start at 7. It's a little past. The room is still filling up. I bet we have to put out more chairs. And you know what's really inspiring about this? There are a lot of young people here. A great number of young folks. I'm not exactly ancient, mind you, but college students and even younger here. I am ably assisted by my... John Fox, if you're around, I'm not sure, is he a gaffer or a best boy? Ferg's with me tonight. Here we go. Hold on. I'm going to shut up. Some audio problems here.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Hey there. Last person in the world you expected to hear this evening, right? Right. You expected to hear the dulcet tones of Bob Kincaid tonight. And I'm sorry to disappoint you. Because after all, who can fill Bob's shoes? Maybe that's not a good analogy. I've got a size 13D here, but you know what I'm saying. Anyway, here we are. Guy James here with you, trying my best to fill in for Bob this evening. I know he's probably banging his head against the wall right now with technical issues up at Institute West Virginia. Little different phone number here if you'd like to call in this evening, 876, well, wait a minute, let's do the 866 number, 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254, it's a toll-free number, and if you've got a, one of those plans where you can just call anybody anytime you want to and you just got all kinds of minutes left, you can call us at 941-876-6896. Never done this slot before on the Head On Radio Network. What do you folks usually talk about tonight, this evening? Oh, I get it. It's got something to do with politics, right? All right. I'm catching on now. For those of you that have never listened to my show, I'm on from 3 to 5, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and we talk about politics all the time, talked about it this afternoon, and I don't know where we'll go this evening. I do hope you'll help out and join the program. Be most happy to hear from you. Again, 866-546-5254. I was mentioning I was at Institute West Virginia a long time ago. It's been so long ago that Rockefeller was the governor down there then. And my wife and I were there on that little campus. It seems to me that, what do they call it? The main course of study there was, I can't even think of it now. But anyway, we enjoyed our stay there at Institute West Virginia. It was in the wintertime, and I remember it snowed like hell. That much I do know. But an interesting place, a little out-of-the-way place, Institute West Virginia. It's a nice small little college there. And of course, Ray McGovern was going to talk this evening, and I'm very, very sorry you didn't get a chance to hear Ray McGovern. I know Ray very well. I've had a chance to be with him many times, and Ray is one heck of a guy and one interesting guy. He's a great guy to sit down and have dinner with, because you start picking his brain and some pretty interesting things come out, being with the CIA and all, him and Dave McMichael and Larry Johnson and all. What they don't know about what's going on inside the walls of the CIA, I guess probably isn't worth knowing. Yes, it is prayer meeting tonight on the Bob Kincaid Show, and I'm afraid that Bob is an expert at conducting this prayer meeting, and I'm a neophyte. I mean, not that I haven't said a prayer before, but as far as actually running a prayer meeting, I really don't know where to go with it. I really don't. So you'll have to bear with me on that. Talked all day today, and I know one of the things Ray was going to talk about tonight is this disgusting situation with the Pentagon actually propagandizing the entire country with these so-called military analysts. It is really appalling that our government would engage in this sort of propaganda. And it's one of those things that's unforgivable for the Bush administration to have done such a thing. The effort, as I understand it, was led by one Mr. Dick Cheney. And it's something that I think is probably the most egregious thing that's been done since the war's been started. Start yourself a war and then get your propaganda machine up and running. We have several of these so-called military analysts that were working for the military-industrial complex, making a few bucks on the side out there promoting the war. So in the meantime, they were stuffing their pockets with cash and pushing Bush's war. So Bush was happy. The military suppliers were happy. Everyone was happy. The lobbyists were happy. Everybody's making money. In the meantime, lots of people dying. Lots of Americans dying. Lots of Iraqis dying. And it's beginning to show in the polls. Bush now with the lowest rating that anybody's had ever since the polls started. We talked on our program yesterday to Professor Alan Lichtman from American University, explaining that the polls have been going on for 70 years, and this is the lowest rating, approval rating, that any politician has ever had, the lowest ever. What a wonderful honor to have the lowest rating that anybody's ever had. Bush must be so proud. But I guess one of the questions I have is this something, do you think, that really even bothers him? Do you think it's something that would concern Bush at all? I get the feeling, watching him speak, that he really doesn't give a damn whether anybody cares about whether he has done the worst job of running an administration ever. I don't think he really cares. I really don't. So we we're stuck with a guy that's got an ego a mile wide and who knows how deep. A man that'll do virtually anything to keep his legacy going, whatever kind of a legacy it is. And my, oh my, I mean, we're in a situation now where he's going to be building a presidential library. And what does a man coming off of a presidency like he's had, what does a man do for a presidential library? What do you put up? I mean, I've been to several presidential libraries, and they have, you know, some of the presidential quotes on the walls and pictures of him doing this, and they're a list of their accomplishments. What would you put in a George Jr. Bush library about his legacy? What quote would you put on the wall, for example? I mean, the Carter Library has some things on the wall. The Gerald Ford has some things on the wall. I've seen several of these. Would you put, is our children learning? Would you put that up in quotes? How many of the bring them on? Would you put that up in quotes? What would you put up in quotes if you were designing the George W. Bush Library? I really don't know. I can't imagine what one would put up. Well, we're coming up on the top of the hour, and we want to keep everything running right on time here. So when we do get to the top of the hour, we'll have news for you coming up then. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, write down the phone number. Those of you who are not used to listening at this time of the evening, 866-546-5254. We're subbing for Bob. If and when he gets going there, why, we'll switch back to him. But in the meantime, you are stuck with me for just a little bit. So don't go away. We'll be back right after the news.
Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The GM layoffs of roughly 3,500 workers at four truck and SUV factories in the U.S. and Canada is the latest blow to auto workers as the U.S. economy slips into recession. Thanks to UAW contracts, the workers will get supplemental income that, together with unemployment benefits, will equal about 80% of their pay. One shift each is being eliminated at each of the four factories, and that will cut production of GM trucks and SUVs by about 50,000 this year. A court has ordered Goya Foods to negotiate with the union that won representation of workers back in 1998. Jesse Russell reports.
The battle between Unite and Goya Foods factory in Miami has waged since 1998, when the union, which has since merged with another union to form Unite here, won the right to represent workers. Over the next decade, Goya incurred multiple charges of unfair labor practices and even fired workers as it sought to break the union's attempt to represent the workers. In 1999, the company stopped negotiation with the union, and it wasn't until August of 2006, after a great deal of back and forth between the National Labor Relations Board and Goya, that the board finally ruled that the company had unlawfully withdrawn union recognition, and the board ordered Goya to resume collective bargaining. Goya appealed, and in a court decision on April 24th, it was recognized that the National Labor Relations Board, taking a decade to determine a ruling, is of considerable concern, but the court supported the board's order. In a statement, Unite Here President Bruce Rayner said 10 years is far too long to wait when bills need to be paid and meals need to be put on tables.
Part-time faculty trying to get their first union contract at Wayne State University in Detroit will pack the school's Board of Governors meeting today. Brian Pfeiffer is with the Union of Part-Time Faculty, AFT.
We have a lot of support in the campus community for us out there, and a lot of people are watching this. Thus far, we have had well over 1,600 letters sent to the president, President Reed, on campus. We have been sending letters to the Board of Governors on campus. Due to this pressure and due to the massive support that we have from labor and community, as well as the students, we feel that this is going to win us a decent contract.
Here is today's economic report. With requests for new home sales declining, the rest of the country has been seeing job slowdowns in the construction industry. New York City, however, continues to see a modest increase. New York State's Metropolitan Transportation Authority says $51 billion in projects are on the slate over the next 4 years in the city. And in March, 2,000 more construction workers were on the job than at the same time last year.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey, John, I just heard you got a new computer. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's the coolest thing.
What will you do with your old computer?
I don't know. I guess I'll just throw it away.
Well, my company just bought new computers, and we decided to donate the old PCs to a place that gives them to local schools. You could do something like that.
Seriously, who would want a 3-year-old computer?
Hey, it might be great for someone else. Computers can be refurbished and reused instead of ending up in the trash. By passing it on, you can help the community and the environment.
If you're replacing your company's IT equipment or you're finished using your personal computer, pass it on to a local organization that accepts computers. To learn more, log on to epa.gov/passiton. This message was brought to you by EPA, Dell, Intel, HP, NEC, Philips, and this radio station on behalf of EPA's Plug Into eCycling Partnership. EPA does not endorse any commercial services or products of these groups. For information on all partners, log on to epa.gov/plugin.
Yes, sirree, back with you. No, I am not Bob Kincaid, to answer your question. Of course, all you Bob fans know that. I'm Guy James, and I'm filling in for Bob for, right up until the top of this hour, up until 9 o'clock. Bob having some technical difficulties over there in Institute, West Virginia. Always thought that was an odd name for a town. Anyway, know what it's like. And somebody mentioned on the chat room a while ago that it would be interesting indeed to hear Bob's comments at the moment. I know what that's like. Been out on the road. Been out doing a remote, and all of a sudden, oh my God, something's wrong. Some little technical glitch that probably a little tweak here, a little tweak there, and you'd be up and running, but you're panicking. Well, I'm panicking. Bob's a tech expert, but I'm not. But I've done that. Been to Washington one time doing a remote, and all of a sudden, bam, I'm gone and don't know why. And I'm it happens. It happens. That's what we get for being ahead of our time here on the Head On Radio Network. Sometimes we have a little glitch or two, and I know you understand. So thanks very much for all of you for being with us this evening. Again, that phone number, if you want to call the program tonight, not the usual number you call this time of evening, it's 866-546-5254. I do hope you'll give us a call. You know, once in a while, when you get to be my age, you discover, and I hate to admit this, and so don't just keep it amongst yourselves, will you? I hate to admit that with a lot of things, I'm out of it. I'm just completely out of it. And I was looking, during the news there, I was looking at a few things up on the news channel here, and I ran across this showbiz thing. I'm not really big into showbiz, but if anything points out how over the hill you are once in a while, or how just You remember when you were a kid? A lot of you don't remember when you were my age, but I remember when I was a kid sitting watching the Beatles come on the Ed Sullivan Show. Mm-hmm. And my parents sitting there watching the Beatles going, oh, my God, this is terrible. This is disgusting. Look how long those guys' hair is. It's just awful. It's terrible. And that's when Ed Sullivan only showed the Beatles, showed Elvis from the waist up. He wouldn't even show that. That's how arcane TV was in those days. But I was, to show you just how far out of it I am these days, and maybe some of you feel the same way I do about it, I saw this list of the sexiest women in show business. And it's the top 15 sexiest women in show business. And I looked down through it, and I only ever heard of one of them. One. One out of the top 15. I have no idea who these other people are. Maybe some of you do, but I don't. I don't pay a lot of attention to show business, but I don't walk around with my head in the sand. But, yeah, out of the top 15, and it's not something I normally talk about, there's that Angelina Jolie. She's number 12. Of the sexiest women list in Hollywood, and the other 14, I don't even know who they are. Megan Fox, Jessica Biel, Jessica Alba, Scarlett Johansson, Emmanuel Shrieker, I don't know what it is, Trisha Heffer or something like that, Kate Beckinsale. I don't know who these people are. So I looked at that and I thought, Rihanna, Erica Durance, Eva Mendez, Hayden Panettiere, Kate Beckinsale, Blake Lively, Trisha Helfer, Hilary Duff, Emmanuel Shrikwe, I've killed that name, I'm sure, Scarlett Johansson, Jessica Albee, Jessica Biel, and Megan Fox. I heard of one of those people before. So I'm really... I don't think I'm embarrassed over that, but it does remind one that maybe you aren't quite up to date on what's going on in showbiz. And that's all right with me. I'm not a big showbiz fan anyway. I guess a lot of you know that. Pardon me if I'm a bit unprepared, because I just happened to tune in this evening and see that there was a problem going on, and so... but they want to know which one I knew of. I knew of the Angelina Jolie. Jolie, whatever. The one with the big lips. That's the only one I ever heard of on that entire list. Probably some of you sitting there going, no, I know them all, or boy, are you out of it. Man, you have your head in the sand, all that. I think more of the political side of thing. Now, if you ask me who the top 15 sexiest people in politics are, I'd probably be able to, well, maybe not. anyway, I'm going to try and have a good time with you for this next hour. You know, there used to be a saying here in this country, and again, it goes back a long, long time, so maybe you've heard it and maybe you haven't, but as General Motors goes, so goes America. And I remember having been brought up in Ohio about once or twice a year. My dad would drive us up to Detroit to see the Cleveland Indians play the Detroit Tigers in baseball. And just outside of Detroit, there was a big billboard. And that's what it had on it. It was just down the road from the Fisher Body Plant. As General Motors goes, so goes America. And a big old flag up there beside that. And there was also a sign down the road said, when better cars are built, Buick will build them. And then on down the road, there was another billboard for a short while said, better cars are being built and Ford is building them. So they always had this sign thing going up there. But as General Motors goes, so goes America. And it's, I don't care about General Motors one way or another, but what I do worry about is Toyota has topped General Motors in global sales. Imagine that. Do you remember when Toyota first started being shipped to this country? You remember when anything Japanese here in this country was considered to be just junk? I remember when the first Honda motorcycle was shipped over here. I remember the first Honda cars were shipped over. And they were junk. They really were. But in short order, the Japanese figured out how to produce things that were made very, very well and very competitive with our goods, and it wasn't long before they were challenging them in sales. And in fact, I'll let you in on a little secret. I always rode motorcycles when I was younger, and I did not ride Japanese motorcycles. I rode English motorcycles, Triumphs, Nortons, and BSAs. That's what I loved, and I still love English motorcycles. But anyway, there was a saying in those days when they had Honda first shipped their first motorcycles over here, a little motorcycle called the Honda Dream, and it had white wall tires, and it was an ugly thing. And you had to be kind of like the nerdy type to have one of those things. It's more like a girl's bike, if you know what I mean. No insult to the girls. But we guys who rode motorcycles in those days, we had a saying, rather my sister be a whore than my brother be seen on a Honda. Oh, yeah, now that I've offended everybody. But that's how bad it was with Japanese stuff. But then they got competitive, and little by little by little, they just made the American automakers look really bad, quality-wise. And now I think the American auto industry has completely rebounded, and I think the American auto industry makes wonderful cars all across the board. I think Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, fabulous automobiles they make now. And in my opinion, every bit as good as any foreign car. But whoever thought that you would read a story that says Toyota is ahead of General Motors in global sales? Every year seems to be Toyota's year, but this could really be the year for Toyota, because worldwide, Toyota sold 2.41 million vehicles during the first quarter of 2008, and General Motors only had 2.25 million, and that's this nation's number one car company. But if that trend continues, Toyota will probably be the global sales leader for the entire year. And as an American, that bothers me. I mean, General Motors has been a great company over the years, but here's the company that exemplified business in America, exemplified the power of American production capacity, and now they're second place to Toyota. I guess it's a sign of things to come. I think we'll be reading more stories like this. I think we're being conquered economically, and I will be honest with you. I often complain about this, that, and the other thing on this program and have ideas on how to fix it, but I don't have an idea, a good idea, on how to turn this around. I honestly believe that if we stay on the trend, if we keep up the trend that we're heading on right now, if we stay on these tracks into industrial oblivion, that the day will come, instead of our jobs being shipped to Mexico or to Taiwan, I believe the Chinese will be shipping their low-paying jobs to America for low wages. That's what I really see in the future. If something isn't done about more fair trade, whether we have to put tariffs on, whatever we have to do to get competitive once again, we're going to have to do it. And I don't know what the answer is, but I do believe that somewhere down the road, it'd be 20, 30, 40, 50 years, that China will be the production power, they'll be the economic power in this world, and they'll be shipping their cheap labor, things that they don't want to do, things that like things that we don't want to do now, we ship to Mexico. China will be shipping those jobs here. Unless we find some way to reverse that trend. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, and I think we're headed that way because of the vast disparity and the distribution of wealth we have in this country right now, that not enough people give a damn. We've got this top 1% of people who are doubling their income in the last 4 or 5 years, and we've got the other 99% below who are actually making less money, comparatively speaking, in purchasing power than they were 7 or 8 years ago. And we can't have the entire country running off of service jobs. We can't have everybody working at McDonald's and Arby's and taking tickets at the local theater. We were an industrial nation, And we're going to have to get some of that industrial power. Oh, yes. I hear over and over and over and over again from the administration, from others, well, we're high tech now. Well, that may be. That may be. We are high tech now. And but it, the industrialization of America is what built this nation from the ground up. And we need something for jobs. High tech is not going to provide all the jobs we need for a 300 million country nation, population nation, and a population, by the way, that's sure to grow to a hell of a lot more than 300 million. So something has to be done. I mean, you look at the capacity for jobs across this country. How many people, 50, 60 years ago that were involved in agriculture? Well, today there's only about 10% of the people that were involved in agriculture 50 or 60 years ago. So we've lost all those jobs. We've lost so many automaking jobs. The steel industry is virtually gone in this country. The clothing industry is gone. All these jobs that we had in this country are gone. And frankly, I don't know how they're going to be replaced. I just don't know. I've thought a lot about it. I live in an area where there's a tremendous amount of wealth, certainly not on my end, but a tremendous amount of wealth, and people totally with a total disconnect from the problem we're having in this country economically nowadays. I see more and more people worried. I see more and more people with stress. More of the middle-class people losing their homes, losing their cars, buried with credit card debt. And yet people that live just a few miles from here, say on Gulf Drive in Naples, Florida, with $20, $30, $40 million homes that have no idea what's going on in this country economically, nor do they care. As long as their portfolio is in decent condition, and it is with most folks because the stock market's hanging right in there. Again, a complete disconnect. And just to point out what I'm talking about China. China, you know, you always saw these pictures of them riding around on bicycles and everybody dressed in black clothing. Things are changing there. The Americans are starting to shy away from the gas-guzzling SUVs and the luxury cars, but there's getting to be a big market for them in China now. That's just what the U.S. car companies are banking on, and some of China's more prosperous car buyers are becoming enamored with those big, beautiful Cadillac Escalades from General Motors. That's right. It's happening in Japan. There's a lot of people emerging with a boatload of money in China, and one of GM's Chinese executives say that, quote, if you look at the fastest-growing market segments in China, there are two, SUVs and luxury cars. I'll bet you didn't know that. Auto sales in China are exploding, and they're going to have a growth of 15 to 20% just since 2007. And believe it or not, Chinese automobile retailers can't even keep SUVs and luxury cars on their lots because their sales are going up by as much as 45 and 50%. Who would have thunk it? And Chinese consumers, of course, are starting to enjoy a very robust economy for, I think, the fifth straight year. The housing industry, they've got a real housing boom. They've got a stock market boom. Completely unlike what's going on in the U.S., where people are holding on to their cars and driving them longer and longer as the economy gets more and more shaky. Certainly more shaky, unless you're watching the Business Channel and they're going to tell you how good things are now. They're doing their very best to talk things up in this country, but I don't think, well, they can talk the stock market up all they want to, but I don't think average Joe American is that happy with what's happening right now across the country. We're going to pause for a short break, and we'll be back in just a minute or two, so don't go away.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Midnight Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications,
sure
direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Hey, thanks for lending an ear.
John McCain has done more than just embrace George Bush's failed policy in Iraq. It's actually his idea to escalate the war there. It's John McCain's idea to send tens of thousands more soldiers to Iraq and to keep them there with no timeline for bringing them home. The McCain plan to escalate, going from bad to worse.
You're listening to the Bob Kincaid program here on the Head On Radio Network, and no, I'm not Bob. Nobody's Bob. Bob is Bob, and I'm Guy James filling in for Bob tonight. He had a few technical difficulties over there at the university. It's a shame, but it happens, and we'll do our best to keep you informed and entertained right up till the top of the hour. Got an email during the break there, and somebody mentioned one of my favorite phrases. that you rarely hear nowadays. And thanks, Vince, for sending that. mentioned about the Republican compassion and compassionate conservatives. You remember that term? You don't hear them utter that anymore, do you? I haven't heard him say anything about it for a long time. It was a buzzword during the election and somewhere after that, you know. But you just don't hear him brag about their compassionate side anymore, because God knows the Republican conservatives, the neocons, don't have a compassionate side. I doubt any of them know what that word means, and it's always been odd to me that these people so selectively display compassion for their own people. They do know what it means when they're talking about each other. And it's one of those situations where it's just kind of like, screw everyone else. But when a member of their family needs some help, needs some compassion, they'll see to it that they move heaven and earth to aid one of their own. That's how it works, just that small little group. And I can think of several outstanding examples of what I'm talking about here. And one of them, I was just reading a story the other day. I forget the gentleman that wrote the book. He wrote a book about Nancy Reagan. Now, before you start in with the, oh no, guy, don't speak ill of an aging former first lady who's lost her husband, let me say that I do sympathize with Nancy over the plight of her husband before he passed on, and I know that's a terrible ordeal. But the only difference is that I sympathize with everyone who suffered the same fate. Everyone. But Nancy was a big supporter of her husband's policies of cutting taxes for the rich and their saber rattling and getting rid of the school lunch programs and taking the kids off the welfare. Anything to get rid of spending a buck on somebody that needed it. But when it involved her family, a conservative Republican family, is all of a sudden an advocate for stem cell research. Now, you don't hear any Republicans that advocated stem cell research, but until... You know, something that was something Nancy Reagan's own husband wouldn't have anything to do with. And what a coincidence that after having to take care of her husband during his illness for several years, she has some sort of an epiphany about stem cell research. And I know, I'm talking about an old lady here and all that, but that's one of the better examples of it I can think of. And after seeing the devastation of Alzheimer's that visits on American families close up, then she changed her mind. And that's what it takes in so many of these cases. And how about gun control? Do you know even one Republican conservative who's in favor of doing something, anything meaningful about the gun madness in this country? I do. I know one only, one, James Brady, and I'm not so sure he's a Republican anymore, but he was a confirmed advocate of Reagan's policy, which, by the way, abhorred gun control of any kind. Any idea where James Brady stands on gun control now? Do you know that they have recently passed a law in Florida? Well, we've had a law in Florida for a long time where you can pack a sidearm if you want to. You got a permit, you can pack a sidearm. You can take a car, you can have it under your seat in your car. You can have it hidden in your car. You can keep a sidearm in your car. And now they passed a rule recently where you can take it to work with you, because we had a lot of employers complaining about people taking guns to work and banned them from taking guns to work in their cars in the parking lot. And so now, how's that going to work out? I don't know. And since I do live in Florida, Jeb Bush has been around speaking a lot lately, I've seen. He spoke here locally not too long ago. And, you know, here's another case of that. Here's a leading figure in a party that harbors the majority of Americans racist. Yes, swallow that. It's the truth. Think about it. Go look at the... Go look at the House of Representatives. Go look at the United States Senate. Tell me how many black folks are in there on the left side. And you tell me how many, especially in the House, okay? Walk into the House of Representatives and stand up on the podium where the speaker stands and look out at both sides of the aisle and count the faces that aren't lily white over on the right side of the aisle. And let me know, what's that number again? What is that number? Huh? Huh? I'll tell you what it is. Zero. Zero. So when I talk about the party that harbors the majority of American racists, I think there's some proof of that. But Jeb's been around speaking a lot lately, and he's been out there talking about how nasty it is for people to talk about immigrants. Well, you got to hand it to Jeb and his compassionate attitude, but then Jeb's wife is Mexican, you see. And couldn't be that Jeb pandered to the Miami Hispanic community for votes, could it, all the while he was here? Oh, no, he wouldn't do that. And Dick Cheney, of course. As long as we're pointing out Republican hypocrites, what a compassionate guy there. The most powerful man in the Republican Party. Yes, he is. He has run the show. He is the puppet master. He's the guy that's laid it all out there ever since Junior Bush has been in office. You remember when Junior asked Dick to chair the committee or to pick a vice president or find the candidates? And Dick said, well, you know, I think, Mr. President, I think I'd be the ideal candidate to be the vice president of the United States. I think that would work for me. Well, yeah. And he took over, and he's been running the country ever since. And we've found out with this horror of the torture memos and all these things going back and forth that Dick Cheney really has been pulling the strings all along, that we really do have a puppet for a president and Cheney. But Cheney, getting back to his compassion, what a compassionate guy. The most powerful man in the Republican Party, I don't think there's any question about it, he is the most powerful figure in the party that's proudly homophobic, and he has a lesbian daughter who, with her partner, gives birth to a child, and then when asked about it by the press, Cheney gets all indignant. You remember that? Whoa. Oh, it is terrible. And his wife, you know, whom I just dearly love, Lynn, what a spectacular woman she is. But you don't see Dick Cheney defending other gay people now, do you? Hmm? No. Only in his family. And you remember when Trent Lott, good old Trent Lott, had his house swept away down there in Katrina. Now, Trent's making the big bucks as a lobbyist now, making big bucks as a lobbyist. Well, he had his house taken away in the Katrina disaster, and he squealed like a stuck pig. But this was after all these tax cuts and wanting this bankruptcy bill and across the board cuts and the social programs. But he loses his house, and oh my God! I mean, gee whiz, we've got to fight the big bad insurance industry now. But before he lost his home, there was no talk of that. Eh. And let's not forget our good friend Rush Limbaugh in this. As many of you know that listen to my program, Rush, the drug junkie Limbaugh, coward that he is, doesn't even have enough nerve to go buy his own drugs. He had to send his maid out to Denny's parking lot to buy them. But Rush's conservative passion just knew no bounds. He talked for years about how we should throw drug offenders in jail for life and throw away the key. And he made fun of the treatment of the prisoners in Gitmo. Remember the little tunes he had made up? And he even sold T-shirts that said Club Gitmo on them. Rush was always just about the best example of a lack of compassion of Republicans until Rushy Boy got busted for drug abuse. And oh, what a different tune he sang then. You remember that? No more talk of throwing people in jail and throwing away the key. No, sir. Rush was being persecuted by the law. It was unfair. It was overzealous. It was just awful. But then Rush was all of a sudden very glad to be protected by a high-priced lawyer and post-bail, the kind of thing that he'd talked negatively about for many, many years. And then there's those champions of personal responsibility, Bob Ney, who's out of prison now, and Mark Foley, a thief and a pervert, and most of them, both of them ran to the protection of rehab, away from the press and away from the personal accountability that they demanded from everybody else. Ney's out now. He's living in Columbus, Ohio. He's in a halfway house. Been hired for a radio job in Columbus, Ohio. Imagine that. A radio job on the left. Imagine that. Bob Ney. But, you know, this list of compassionate conservatives who have compassion only for themselves is very, very long. Jack Abramoff. Scooter. And I think you get my point. Conservatives are really, by and large, not capable of feeling compassion until trouble comes knocking on their own doors. And if you think that's an awful thing, then you're absolutely right. And if you think these people think nothing at all about taking a piece of bread and a bowl of soup away from some indigent adult or hungry child so that they can buy another home in the tropics, then you're right, because it's not in their makeup to feel any compassion for those who have any less. And this just doesn't leave us with many options. We have really only one realistic option to solve this problem. And we can't, of course, nor would we want to get rid of these kinds of people from our society. They've got a right to exist the same as we do. But what we can do is get rid of them in our government. Totally wipe them out of the seats of power in this country. Totally wipe the slate clean of these kinds of people in government in this country. And we should know by now that their having the reins of power is dangerous to the greater good of the very vast majority of Americans. The damage the conservative movement has done to the people of this country is absolutely incalculable. The damage they've done to our national prestige around the world is perhaps beyond repair right now. It's going to take a long, long time, probably decades, for our next president to go in and repair the damage diplomatically that this administration has caused. And we have every reason to shun these people and keep them out of power. We have to stop allowing them to use their wealth and power to force their horrific policies down our throats that they've been doing now for the last, what, three decades? We've got to stop them from advancing their agenda of unending wars and torture without thought, piling up massive debt that the working class is going to have to pay, and keeping decent health care only for themselves. We have to stop them from ripping the Constitution of the United States to shreds when it suits them. It has to stop. And I probably butcher it. I can't remember the exact phrase right now, but it was Karl Marx who said, "People get the government that they deserve." I believe that's how he said it. And my question to all of you is, don't we deserve better than this? Don't we deserve a government that will work for us instead of the top percent, 1% of the rich and the powerful few? I think we do. And I think we absolutely must take back America. And you know what? I think we're going to get it done this fall. I do. We're going to get it done. Whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, and right now it does look like it's going to be Barack Obama, I think we will get it done. And once we get it done, and once we increase the margin in the House and the Senate, do remember that if we have a Democratic president, we won't need 60 seats in the Senate. I think we'll end up with 55, maybe 56. But we won't have a president with a veto pen in his hand for every last thing that, you know, he wants to veto everything. I think the Republican, I think the Republicans right now are standing on 68. I think they've tossed out 68 bills that the Democrats have put up so far. I'm pretty sure that's what it is, 68. Bush hasn't vetoed that many. They've filibustered 68. I think that's a new record. So it's very important, not just to get a Democratic president. Of course, that's number one right now. But we've got to work hard on your local elections with your Senate candidates and your House candidates. There's a lot of good Democrats running. A lot. And I know we're going to take a bigger majority in the House, and I know we're going to take a bigger majority in the Senate. We'll probably finally take a majority in the Senate because, let's face it, we really haven't had one at this time. So it's important that we pay attention to all of the elections taking place around the country in your state and your particular area. We're going to pause for a quick break. We'll be right back.
You have stuck with the surge and stuck with your position on the surge in Iraq from the beginning. And as you probably know, one of the most viewed videos now on YouTube is the video of you saying, interjecting when someone talks about being in Iraq for 50 years, and you say, could be 100 years. Explain that.
Could be 1,000. Could be 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years. We could be a...
Are you a conservative Republican who believes George W. Bush did the right thing by invading Iraq? Are you in agreement with Mr. Bush when he says, we need to stay the course no matter how long it takes? Do you agree with the president when he says that he will never set any time schedule to pull out our troops? Well, if you agree with all that, then you'll certainly want to help out Mr. Bush by signing up your kids or grandkids for military service today. Yes, just call your local Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marine recruiter and tell them the age and social security number of your little Johnny or Susie and make an appointment for a free visit by your local military recruiter. We know that by supporting the president's war, you are a super patriot, and you'll want to be the first on your block to offer up your kids for Mr. Bush's war. Don't worry if you think they're too young. Even if they're only 10 or 11 years old, this war will certainly last long enough for them to get involved. And for the first 15 callers, we're offering absolutely free a CD of the president uttering those famous fighting words, bring 'em on. Yes, this CD will have special meaning to you, especially if your kid is wounded or killed in Iraq. So call now and get your child or grandchild registered today. Just call 1-800-TAKE-MY-KID. That's 1-800-TAKE-MY-KID.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
The Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, they don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Not unless you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year. And a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run without scissors,
it's the least you can do.
Little bayou music there, and down in the bayou down south of Baton Rouge. Love that area down in there. Went to a football game at Baton Rouge one time. As most of you know, I'm a big Ohio State University fan. Went down to Baton Rouge to see the Buckeyes play LSU in Baton Rouge. What an experience. What an experience. Love that place. Beautiful campus. Probably one of the best places in America, not probably, maybe the best place in America to go to a football game in terms of excitement and the crowd and the southern culture and all. Oh, what am I doing talking about football? You don't want to hear about football, do you? No, I didn't think so. 866-546-5254, give us a call. Hey, how about that latest poll? How about the latest poll that shows Hillary Clinton 9 points up on John McBush? What do you think? 9 points up. It shows Obama and McCain in virtually a dead heat. And do you think there is a way, anyway, that Hillary Clinton can now win the nomination? And if you don't, why on earth would someone as intelligent as her and the people who run her campaign keep on going if they didn't have a solid reason? And think about this. If they don't have a solid reason that they can win this, why would they keep on going? Why would they keep beating their heads against the wall if they didn't think they had a decent chance to win this? Now, I know she's dogged. I know she's a tireless worker. So is Obama. Imagine being in their shoes, either of their shoes right now, up at 6 in the morning, going to bed at midnight or after, talking to people you don't know, shaking hands with people you don't know, smiling at them every day, listening to their inane comments. Oh, my God, I love you. I'm so happy that you're running. Imagine hearing that day after day after day and having to drone on with the same campaign speeches. Yes, the same ones day after day. They have a little, group of speeches that they give, four or five that they give, depending on the size of the crowd and where they're at. And they're changed a little bit here, a little bit there, tweaked here and there. But basically it's doing the same thing for over a year now. 7 days a week. Oh, my God. I can't imagine doing that. I really just cannot imagine doing that. So if you think that Hillary doesn't have a chance of getting that nomination, why on earth would they keep going is what I'd like to know. And I've thought a lot about this, and I figure they must think that they've got a damn good chance at it. I do. I think they must think so themselves, or they would not be doing this. So, what is the chance? I would tell you my opinion of what I think the chance is. And yes, the superdelegates, and don't forget, a lot of people had a lot of fun with the superdelegate thing. I believe the superdelegates make up about 19% of the of what the number of pledged delegates are in the Democratic Party. But the Republicans have superdelegates as well, and they make 20%. They don't have as many delegates, but the Republicans have 20% of their delegate count in superdelegates. So it's not just something that the Democrats do. The Republicans do it as well. The Democrats have just done it more stupid, that's all. I think the Democrats have shown this year that they've outfoxed themselves. They've outthought themselves. What they've done with this primary campaign is every bit as egregious as some of this redistricting that goes on around the country, drawing through people's backyards and trying to include a certain group in a House district. And, you know, some of that is really ridiculous. And the Democrats have done about the same thing with this primary. I don't know whether the best idea is to go back to the winner take all. I'd like to see it on a percentage basis. You go into a state that has 100 delegates and you get 60% of the vote, you should get 60 delegates and the other person should get 40. Or whatever percentage, if there's four or five of them in it. You should take home what you got. I don't know what the answer is, but all I know is this isn't the way it ought to be run. But I'll tell you this. For those of you that regularly listen to my show, you know that I believe, and I truly believe, that this little squabble that they've had, this primary that they've had between Barack and Hillary, I do not believe that it's been terribly damaging to the party. I really don't. How much have you heard about John McCain lately? This is a time that John McCain ought to be out, be able to get a lot of press and all that, but he's taken a back seat to the Democratic primary. We're getting both candidates completely vetted. Hillary was already completely vetted, I believe, and Barack is in the process of getting completely vetted. But I don't think, I'm going to take the opposite view of most of the pundits and prognosticators of this whole thing. I do not believe that the party is getting terribly hurt by this. I really don't. In fact, I think it's healthy. And I think when we come out of the convention, if it goes to the convention, and it very well might, I think we're going to come out with one hell of a strong candidate, either of which will beat John McCain handily. That is my guess. I just believe that, yes, we're hearing these stories that the Hillary people won't vote for Obama and the Obama people won't vote for Hillary. Poppycock. Poppycock. As I always say, look on the other side of the fence and see what's over there. And I think the voters in the Democratic Party are very intelligent, very progressive, very, very, very smart. And although they'll be upset at not having their candidate win the primary, I do believe they'll look at the alternative. I do believe that they'll see that John McCain is nothing more than Bush 3, and they will fall into line. Not like lemmings, like the Republicans do. They'll think it through, and they'll understand that our candidates are, although in some ways very different, on their policies, they're very, very close. And I think they'll all fall in line. I absolutely, positively do. We shall see. If I'm absolutely right about this, I'll probably be working in the next campaign as a consultant. If I'm wrong, well, you know. Anyway, I don't think this whole thing is hurting us. I think the polls are very, very interesting. It's showing so far that Barack Obama is not getting terribly hurt by this Reverend Wright thing. Is the Reverend Wright thing over with? No, I don't think so. I think maybe the worst of it's over for him, and he'll have to wear this on his shoulders all through the general election if he is our candidate. They will bring this up, and they will tar and feather him with it. But I think the worst of it's over, as it should be. It should have been such a flap in the first place. I don't know in all my years of following politics that I've ever seen anything as absurd as this mess with this Reverend Wright. I just don't think so. As I mentioned on my program this afternoon, who is Reverend Wright? He has a big church in Chicago, sure, but nobody else ever heard of the guy. Nobody knew who he was. It's not as though he were a Billy Graham or I say it with firm tongue firmly in cheek, a Falwell or a Robertson or somebody like that. It's not as though he were famous. It's not as though it really mattered what he preached on Sunday morning. To me, it's not important at all that Barack Obama went to that church for 20 years. Listen, when I lived up north, I belonged to a certain church for a long, long time. And ministers come and ministers go, and I realize he had his for 20 years, but sometimes you get a minister in a church, in a Protestant church, that you just don't care for. And you may not agree with what he has to say. He may say some things sometimes you think damn stupid or really off the wall. But you've gone to church there for a long time. Your family's gone to church there. You may live right directly in that community. Everybody else goes to that church. You don't get up and walk out of a church because of a minister doing that. You don't. So I don't know. I think it's been much ado about nothing. I really do. And to tell you the truth, although I voted for Hillary Clinton in the primary here in Florida and have been, I don't want to say on the bandwagon, but I've been a Hillary Clinton supporter for a long time. Yeah, go ahead and throw the rocks. I just think this has been terribly unfair to a very, very fine American and a very, very fine candidate for the presidency of the United States. It's been totally unfair. And to keep this going the way the press has, just over and over and over again, frankly, to drone on about it every night, and I'm sure they're talking about it on the talk shows. Well, I'm talking about it on the talk show. It's enough. Enough is enough. Leave the man alone. He's explained it well enough to suit me. And do I believe that he never heard that minister say any of those offensive things? Probably not. He probably did know that minister had said so. I don't know how he could not know that. Do I care? No. Hell no, I don't care. Do want to remind everybody that's here this evening that I'm just filling in, doing my best to fill in, however inadequate it may be to all you Bob Kincaid fans. Bob had some technical trouble out trying to do a remote this evening with Ray McGovern speaking over at West Virginia State University, over at Institute West Virginia, and it didn't work out so well. Bob had some technical troubles, and I know he's probably highly upset because Bob is a good tech guy, and it should have been something that probably was something that was just, you know, maybe in the hall. I don't know what the problem was, but anyway, that's why you ended up with me this evening. Got Peter Godbold coming up at the top of the hour at 9 o'clock, and I know you all want to tune in for that. Peter always has a good show. I don't get on the chat room because I'm always thinking about turning in, not too long after that, but I listen as long as I can. And so Peter will have a good program for you coming up at 9 o'clock. I guess we're getting down to the point where we can't take a call right now. I was going to give you the number again. But I do want everybody to remember, please, that it's important at this time of year. We've all listened to this campaign rhetoric for a long time now, and I know many of us, we're getting tired of it. We're getting weary. We're getting fatigue. We're getting election fatigue. But we've been in it for this long now, and we've got to keep going. It's very important for the future of this nation that we change administrations and that we sweep the conservative Republicans right out of Washington. And your interest is important. Your actions are important. If you get out and work for a local Democratic club, if you're a precinct worker, do what you can. Talk to your conservative neighbors. Talk to your conservative friends. It's important that we keep this up every day until Election Day. And we'll be oh so glad we did. We may not be 100%. You may not be 100% chance happy with. No one ever is 100% happy with any president. But just do remember, no matter which side you're on, for Hillary or Barack, they're two great candidates, and either of them is going to be a much, much, much better president than Junior Bush, his daddy, or Ronald Reagan. So that is a fact. That is something you can count on. And it's going to, that's a promise to you. Always remember to look across the fence and see that horrible, ugly, conservative neocon monster that's waiting over there to grab some more of your money, to grab some more of the power, and to take some more of the wealth of this country. So as fatigued as we are with all this election that's been going on for, it seems like, half a lifetime now, there's not that much longer left. We've only got till November. What do we got? We got May, June, July, August, September, October. 6 months and a few days. That's all. And we've been in it now for twice that long already, and it's not going to kill us to hang on for a while longer. So, you know, do your homework every day. Keep up on the issues. Be prepared to argue and argue your point and win your point with your conservative friends. It's not that hard to do because they're kind of lacking in enthusiasm right now. I know a lot of them have jumped off the conservative boat and are ready for something different. I'm hearing that more and more, and I'm extremely heartened by all that. So I think we're going to do fine, and I think we're going to have a Democratic president coming up. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening and sticking with me here on the Bob Kincaid program. It's been a pleasure filling in for Bob. I mean, after all, who can really fill in for Bob Kincaid? Wednesday night prayer meeting. We didn't have much of a prayer meeting between you and I, but I just pray that you have a good evening and a good day tomorrow. And Bob will be back with you tomorrow evening, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready to roll. So, I'll let you go. This is Guy James from The Guy James Show, and as I always say, you've already heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. Stay tuned for Peter coming up at the top of the hour.
Radio kids, it's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore.
So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 138 of this crazy little thing called love that we formally refer to as Strictly Confidential. I want to thank Guy James. Guy James was the host that you heard filling in for Bob. Guy's from South Florida and a veteran in radio and always has lots of people who tune in and listen to him Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 3 till 5 p.m. right here on the Head On Radio Network. We are a far-flung bunch here at the Head On Radio Network. Guy in South Florida and myself in North Florida. We have John over in Australia, and Lord knows where the rest of us are. I know that Mark Levine is in Washington, D.C., but I've kind of lost track of where we all are. In any case, thank you, Guy, for filling it at the last minute. That was a great show. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Stop by crmw.net and see what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday, April 30, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. on a Wednesday evening, April the 30th of 2008, you're listening to a live show, and you're welcome to call in and participate. I'll be giving out those numbers later. If you're listening via podcast, as so many of the listeners do, at a later date that's more convenient to you. Obviously, you can't call in, but nonetheless, welcome and thank you for your emails. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests as well as to the audio archives from past shows. You'll find links there to the chat room, which is active as I speak. A good evening to join us in chat. There are also links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you here on the show. There are also links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com to the main Head On Radio Network site, and there you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which I'm only a small part. You'll find links there and a PayPal button over at headonradionetwork.com to make it easier for you to support the Head On Radio Network. The toll-free line for participating is 877, the number 4, head on. That's 877-4-HEAD-ON. That translates into 877-443-2366 for those of you who like numbers better. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that and save the studio nickel or buck, although we are more than happy to take the calls via 800 or 877 lines. The toll line rings in West Virginia